We welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals this morning. We have one case on our 9 o'clock docket, which we will proceed with in a moment. And we have two cases on our 10:30 docket, so we will take a brief recess and then come back at 10:30 for those two cases. The first case on our docket is Logston versus Logston. If the clerk will please announce who will be arguing, and I've been given the times that you all are splitting your argument already. All right, Mr. Kolodowski.
May it please the court. I represent Mark Allen Logston, adult son of Deborah Kay and Mark Edward Logston. Mark Allen was in the unenviable position of being brought into his parents' divorce case as a third-party respondent. His age was 22 at the time that the trial occurred. After Mark Allen became a third-party respondent, he filed a general denial in this case. As far as Mark Allen is concerned, this case boils down to property. Property that he alleges was his, yet the trial court divided as part of the community estate nevertheless. The specific items of property are identified multiple times in our brief. However, if you'd like a list, it's on page 7 of our opening brief. The disputed property can be divided into two categories. First, funds that Mark Allen earned from work both at Champion Sweeping and other companies, and the property that he purchased with those funds. And the second are gifts that he received from his parents and others, including his grandparents. I would say that this case is somewhat unique in that Mark Allen is appealing after his directed verdict was granted by the trial court. At the beginning of Mark Allen's case in chief, after both his mother and father had their cases in chief at trial, Mark Allen's attorney did two things. First, he made a stipulation on the record with regard to a certain fund transfer that occurred before the case. The divorce case was filed by his mother. That was the $126,000, I believe, and he stipulated that those were part of the community estate. The second thing he did was he made his motion for directed verdict. There are two possible outcomes with regard to this directed verdict, which was granted. First is that it was a full directed verdict. That is, of course, our position, and that it disposed of all claims outstanding against my client. That would be everything that was found in his father's, I believe the title was Third Amended Counterpetition for Divorce, Claim Against Third Party Respondent, and Motion for Additional Temporary Orders. The terminal question with regard to that pleading was ultimately ownership of the disputed property. And that was because Mark Edward was asking the court to declare the assets part of the community estate. When the court granted the directed verdict, that, if it was a full one, adjudicated everything, ultimately the ownership of the property. That is our position. If, however, it was a partial directed verdict, which is what Mark Edwards' attorneys seem to indicate in their brief as their position, and that it only dealt with the damages claims, then my client was deprived of his ability to present his case fully at trial. After the directed verdict was granted, the trial judge moved on to the amicus attorney and ultimately took the case under consideration, and Mark Allen had no opportunity to call witnesses or present evidence.
So did he participate in the trial then? Is that rather your point?
Well, Your Honor, he was at the trial. He was a party to it. His attorney asked questions of the other witnesses. Our point with regard to this is that when the judge granted the directed verdict, there was no reason in his mind or his attorney's mind to put on evidence about ultimate ownership of the property because of...
So that judgment hadn't been entered yet, though, when y'all went to trial?
The judge granted the directed verdict at trial. This then leads us, Your Honor, to what evidence was presented at trial to the underlying ownership. Only two people testified regarding that, Deborah Logsdon and Mark Edward Logsdon. Deborah has been consistent in her testimony at trial and in her briefing on appeal that Mark Allen owns that property. Mark Edward, on the other hand, was not able to testify at trial as to really the ownership. He says, I don't know. I'd like him to prove it to me. None of that amounts to any evidence regarding the ultimate ownership of the disputed property. This is important because the burden was solely on him regarding the disputed property. As a third-party plaintiff, he had the burden of proof. The community presumption did not apply in this case because, according to the specific code language of 3.003 of the Texas Family Code, it applies only between the spouses. Mark Allen was not married to either of his parents. So ultimately, the burden of proof, there was no presumption, and the burden of proof rested with Mark Edward. The one presumption that did apply, however, was the gift to child presumption. I see my time is up.
You can just conclude your statement, please.
The gift to child presumption applies, Your Honor, and ultimately what that means is a parent intends to make a gift to his children if a parent delivers possession, conveys title, or purchases property in the child's name. One cannot think of a better example of this than a parent buying bonds for his children, giving a car for Christmas, and a car at graduation.
Can you tell this court what your prayer for a result is?
Well, first and foremost, Your Honor, we would ask this court to find that the property was Mark Allen's because the directed verdict was granted. If, however, the court is unwilling to do that, our alternative position is that the case be remanded so that Mark Allen can present his claims as to the ultimate, or his evidence as to the ultimate ownership of the disputed property in the trial court. There are no further questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Kolodowski. Mr. Gilstrap.
As to counsel's argument, I would just add that there's a third alternative. The court could find that the husband did not prove ownership. There's no evidence or factually insufficient evidence that he owns the property. Therefore, the adult son wins. Now, that's an important point because and also, I would also add that I think counsel makes it too hard on himself. He says the standard review is abuse of discretion. It's not abuse of discretion. It's just a third-party case between people who aren't married. The standard is legal or factual insufficiency. Now, having said that, if he's right, then a problem comes up for our case because now the court has a characterization problem. The trial court said $77,400 worth of property is in the estate. If they're right, it's not in the estate, and under the Jacobs case, Jacobs against Jacobs, an error in characterization requires that the case be remanded for a new property division because this court cannot divide property, and the Supreme Court has said that requires a new property division. However, Mr. Michel, being his usual adroit self, has come up with an argument, and he says that, well, there's a de minimis rule. Somehow, This $77,400 is so small that we can just ignore it. And he cites a case called McElwee in which the court said $45,000 was not de minimis. If the court is going to say that this is de minimis, it's got a real line drawing problem with McElwee. McElwee was 3%, $45,000. Our case is $77,400 between 2 and 3%. How do you draw the line? The answer is, in both cases, the de minimis rule does not apply. Wherever the border between de minimis and not de minimis is, it's south of these two cases. So the case has to be remanded for a new property division. However, that should not be the end of your treatment of the case, because if it's sent back and the trial judge just splits the 77-4 in some percentage like he split the rest of the case, we still have a problem of disproportionate award. Now, of course, we have a hard test in trying to show that it's disproportionate. The standard is abuse of discretion, and the question we have to ask, is there any reasonable basis for splitting the property so that in this case, the husband gets $575,000 more than the wife? Well, it's not just any reasonable basis. It has to be a reasonable basis based on the evidence. And what kind of evidence? Well, it can't be any evidence. Like they say that, you know, the wife didn't do a good job of sending her daughter to school, or that she was rude to the receiver, or that she had a collection of Beanie Babies. That makes no difference in the property division. The test is the MURFF factors, M-U-R-F-F. We cited that in our brief, although I don't think we cited MURFF. I think we cited Garcia, which cites MURFF. And here are the MURFF factors: age, earning power, capacities and ability, fault in the breakup of the marriage, relative financial conditions, obligations, fraud in the community, wasting of assets, and the nature of the property. Those are the MURFF factors. That's the evidence that has to be the basis of the disproportionate. The evidence has to concern those factors for there to be a disproportionate division. Now, I want to set aside fraud and wasting for obvious reasons, and we'll talk about that in a second. The rest of the factors, you know, favor us. There was evidence that wasn't denied the husband committed adultery. There was evidence of cruelty. There was evidence that the wife had less earning power than the husband. All those factors would militate in favor of a disproportionate property division in favor of the wife. Counsel correctly points out that the court can ignore all that. And let's suppose it does. We're not dealing with a disproportionate division in favor of the wife. We're dealing with a disproportionate division in favor of the husband. What evidence is there that the husband should get more than the wife? Well, there's none, leaving aside fraud and wasting. There's none. There's no evidence that the wife was responsible for the failure of the marriage. There's no evidence that the husband has financial needs that are somehow require him to get more money. There's just no evidence outside of fraud and waste. So we come to fraud and waste, and that's what Judge Harris expressly based his property division on. He cited the Schluter case, and it talks about fraud on the community. The problem is that aside from fraud or waste means that assets pass outside the control of the court. One of the husband, the husband spends $10,000, gives a ring to his mistress who goes to Oregon, and the ring is gone. It can't be gotten back. In this case, all of the assets are accounted for except for one item. And we went through this very laboriously in the brief. The receiver said that he had everything that he knew of. He had gotten it. Now, it took some effort on his part. There's evidence that both sides had taken money and were controlling it when the divorce started, and that they gave it back. But it was all given back. Judge Harris, their principal charge was that there had been a gift to the son. Judge Harris said no, and he took that money back too. You know, and I'm not talking about that one that they're claiming, that there was other money that had been given to the son. There's no evidence of that. It was all accounted for, except for $13,000 in a brokerage account, which at the end of the day, we can't account for it. I'm not saying my client fraudulently took that, but at the end of the day, after it was all done, the lawyers did all their stuff, we read the record, we couldn't account for the $13,000. Okay. If under the standard review, you have to say, well, that's evidence of a fraudulent transfer. Okay, but what's the consequence? They say that the consequence is that the wife gets $575,000 less than the husband. But that can't be the law. That can't be the law. In fact, we have a statute now that has been enacted since Schluter, 7009 of the Family Code. And it says that if the trier of fact determines that a spouse has committed actual or constructive fraud, the court shall, one, calculate the value by which the community estate was depleted, and calculate the amount of the reconstituted estate. Well, what you should do is take the existing property and add the $13,000 to it. That's the reconstituted estate. And then you've got to divide the value of the reconstituted estate between the parties in a manner that the court deems just and right. Well, the MURFF factors still apply here. And if one party is responsible for the breakup of the marriage, the reconstituted estate can be split disproportionately. But what it seems implicit in this is that the court cannot say, well, I've reconstituted the estate. The $13,000 is now in the estate, and I'm going to penalize the wife because she tried to take it out. It's been taken back. What's the point of that? It smacks of double recovery. There's no cases that construe this, but that simply cannot be the law. They have two arguments. Both are very, very difficult for them. First, they say, well, the receiver said he had everything that he knew of. Well, that's everything in the record. They have the burden on fraudulent transfer, and they never proved that there were imaginary assets that somehow the wife had made off that weren't in the record. It was all accounted for except for the $13,000. They also say, well, it talks about fraudulent transfer, and so the wife attempted to, she actually put it over in her bank account. That's a fraudulent transfer, and she can be penalized for that. Well, if that's the case, everything before a receiver is appointed, almost everything in a divorce can be considered as a fraudulent transfer because, you know, it's in one of the other bank accounts. The fact is, it is still in the possession of the parties, it's still in their names, and it's still part of the estate. Fraud requires damages. Judge Harris said, with regard to the alleged transfers to the son, that the husband had not been damaged. There is no evidence of a fraudulent transfer other than the $13,000, and this penalty of $575,000 for a $13,000 transfer is disproportionate. There is no reasonable basis upon which it can be justified. Therefore, there's an abuse of discretion.
What about the purchasing of all the items in the storage unit? Doesn't that constitute wasting?
No, because they're still there. And they were valued, and the wife was, I think, given to them as part of the property. I mean, let's take the worst case. Let's suppose the $10,000 ring, you know. It doesn't go off to Oregon. It's gotten back. There's no waste there. The property has been accounted for. If the property is accounted for, there can't be waste. I believe my time's up.
I've got a question, though. You seem to argue that with regard to fraud on the estate, that this is a mathematical calculation and that it shouldn't be a punitive thing. Yet, if it was infidelity, which is another one of the factors, that's definitely a punitive thing, not a mathematical calculation. So are there some of the factors that are punitive in nature by your argument and some that are mathematical, or how do you?
I don't think any of the factors are punitive. They're arguing punitive. They're saying $575,000 penalty for a $9,000 transfer. And in my response, I say, look at the cases involving.
Well, how do you mathematically calculate fidelity then, infidelity?
Well, I think it's a factor the court can consider, but I'm not sure there was any that fidelity is in the case here. You know,
I understand that, but what I'm asking is if you're going to argue that fraud is mathematically calculated, there's no punitive aspect to it, then how is infidelity a factor?
Oh, infidelity. Well, those are intangibles. And you know, it's a lot harder to say that the court abused its discretion for an intangible. But here we're talking about money.
So basically you're saying that infidelity is a factor like pain and suffering in the sense that there has to be a calculation put on it, but it's not something that's subject to hard numbers, whereas a fraud is subject to hard numbers.
Right. Certainly this fraud is. Certainly there might be some fraud that's not, but certainly in this case.
Are there any cases that discuss this?
No, that's the problem. There are no cases, and there's no cases that I've found construing 7009. There, you're plowing into uncharted waters. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gilstrap. Mr. Michelle.
please the court, Justice Sutterworth, you're exactly right. You've hit the nail on the head on that aspect. And in fact, we don't need to look at any cases to find it because the legislature's already decided the issue for us. We've cited a number of cases on pages 34 and 35 of our brief that discuss fraud. There's not a dollar-for-dollar calculation. This legislature perfectly had an opportunity after Schluter came down, Justice Sutterworth, when they enacted 7.009. They go through this whole mathematical calculation about reconstituting the estate. They say reconstitute it and then divide it. And they go and they put in there, Justice Sutterworth, just as admirable opposing counsel Mr. Gilstrap is articulating, is saying we want a dollar-for-dollar calculation based on the fraud that's proven. Absolutely not. How does the legislature legislatively dictate that that be done, that the trial court do it in a just and right manner? So we specifically reject that contention. The legislature has rejected that contention. We've cited cases where there's not a dollar-for-dollar calculation based on fraud. And then we've really got to hit, there is really a disparity of the characterization of the way we characterize the transactions that have happened. We see a difference of approximately $290,000. We've also put through there, when you deal with fraud, when we've cited these cases, we are dealing with a marital relationship, Justice Sutterworth, of where you have a heightened fiduciary duty of trust to treat the other spouse correctly. We don't have somebody who's in charge of the books, cooking the books, and entering false entries saying that my client, the husband, had been given tens of thousands of dollars of false paychecks that were never given to him so they can cook the books to see like, oh, I've paid husband. You can't transfer hundreds of thousands of dollars to your adult child. And then afterwards, once litigation starts, you investigate the books, you find out that those funds were in fact transferred, catch their hand in their cookie jar, and through the luck of being able to actually recover it, get that money brought back. And that does dovetail into the directed verdict. The record is absolutely clear. When we recovered the money, Mark Allen, the son, stipulated, we've given it back, and that's when Judge Harris said, okay, I'm going to let the son go out, but this is really more appropriately handled between the co-conspirator, he said on the record, co-conspirators between the wife and the adult son. I'm going to handle this in the marital estate because the mother was the actor transferring these fraudulent funds, backdating checks, ignoring court orders, getting held in contempt, doing everything. She had to be removed from the bank accounts. She tried to hack into the bank accounts. The receiver had to open up a new bank account to stop her her thieving of these documents.
Wait a second. Let me ask this.
Yes.
If all of the property that was related to the alleged fraud was returned by the parties, whether voluntarily or under the threat of some cause of action, then really the parties themselves had already reconstituted the community estate.
Through the efforts and expense of
the receiver.
And our own attorney's fees. Don't forget, this was we have it in the record. There were weekly hearings by Judge Harris to get his hands around what this fraudulent activity. The judge had a standing order to show up every Friday. So they have to spend over $100,000 in receivership fees only through April, plus the additional attorney's fees of the husband. And to come down and say King's X, because we recovered some, and granted, and we've cited these case laws, Justice Livingston, that when you have some fraudulent activity, you can't necessarily prove all of the fraudulent activity, and that's the nature of fraud. And so it's not like we're just saying out of the blue, oh, we think there might be more money out there, but we had to investigate five different storage units, find this ridiculous amount of wasted funds on property, and it is waste, because when you spend money on assets that don't then get their value back, that's waste of assets. That's the waste of community funds. We have all of this going on. So if you look at the $290,000, we have $100,000 in receivership fees. We have additional fees.
But let me back up. If you properly value the money, the items that were spent, the items that were purchased, if you properly value it and give it back to the person who wasted it, haven't you accounted for that?
There may be some type of accounting. There's certainly, if there was $10 and $10 was hidden in a drawer, because it's more than just transferring
well,
its
waste. Well, I'm talking about if you had $10 and you bought something that wasn't worth $10.
Yes.
But you value it at $10 and give it back to the and property division to the person who bought it or wasted it, then haven't you evened the playing field?
To some extent. And two, Justice Sutterith, in our opinion, the legislature specifically rejected that approach because otherwise, when they itemize the detailed procedure in 7.009, my logical connection, having followed Schluter and looking at the case law and the legislature, when they come back, it's been a question I've always had with this fraud and this constructive fraud. Is it really a dollar-for-dollar value? And it's not. If they wanted to take that economic approach.
I'm really talking about the waste at this point, not the...
Yeah, the waste. Yes. I guess that's a way to somewhat try to handle it in one way. But I think there's also additional cost to that. There's the cost of recovering it in hundreds of thousands of dollars of transactional costs. Also, it's a wear and tear. There's also, I think, a mental anguish when your fraud is actively defrauding you. We're not just talking about doing kind of things, but active fraud, such that you have to have receivers and spend money to track it down against your son. That's brutal. And that gets to your, not just punitive, but that's emotional. That is hard stuff. I mean, that was a tough decision to have to bring in their adult son. But how else do you get your hands back on that money?
Speaking of the son, do you think it was a, and this is off topic a little bit from what you've already talked about, but do you think it was a partial directed verdict or a full directed verdict?
I think it's unequivocal. It was a partial directed verdict. He had no affirmative claims for ownership of the property. He had a general denial. Can't raise this issue for the first time on appeal that this should have been my property. This burden of proof is, I think, a red herring. What it is you've got property in front of the court. Parties were listening and saying it's ours. He's got no pleading saying it's mine. He calls no witnesses. He wasn't
deprived. Well, but that's because he got the directed verdict. So
on our claim, on our claim for fraud, where just Judge Harris said, look, you've trapped it, you've gotten the bank account. Matthew Reich was his attorney at trial and said, Judge, we stipulate, we're giving it back. And the judge said on the record, listen, you guys, I'm not doing this on not liability. I think you're liable. You're a co-conspirator. But since the son is returning it, I'm going to let you out on the damages. And the reason why that's different, Justice Sutherland, is exactly right. We've got a third party who's engaged in a fraud. And if you don't have the damages in that respect as to a third party outside the marital context, those are apples and oranges.
So you've only pled fraud as to the son. You didn't plead that he had property that belonged to your client.
We believed that it was in his possession. We contended it was our property, or marital property. And we recovered the funds back, and so the direct verdict was granted on those fraud claims. At that point, Mark Allen, the son, had no affirmative pleadings requesting that this is my property and put on no case in chief. He wasn't, and I will say, I'm going to be clear, I'm not aware, and maybe it'll be pointed out in post-submission, but I haven't seen anything in the briefs where Mark Allen's attorney was deprived of an opportunity to call witnesses to prove up his ownership claim, and he had no pleading on it. Once he was joined
to
the party.
Your position that it was their claim of ownership, they're saying you bore the burden of proof, therefore it was your claim of ownership.
I think if you come into the court and you get joined and you have third-party claimants and we claim this is our marital estate, if he wants to claim it's my property, he should come in and have affirmative pleading say, that's mine.
Don't you bear the burden of proof on that? Can he just generally deny that it's your property?
I don't think so. Why? Why would he be able to say that?
Well, can he do that in any lawsuit? Take it out of the marital context.
I would say no. I would say if this is my property, which we did submit testimony and evidence and our property divisions, we put on evidence of our property. He put on no evidence. And the court found it. And as a side issue of all these other alleged factors of Murph factors, I'm changing back now if it's okay. None of those opposing counsel raises that there was evidence of it. Sure, we often have family law cases where somebody says, oh, I've got diabetes, I can't work. No doctor. Worked. Then on the other breath is saying, I work 24/7 building this business. Oh, but now the divorce is filed, I can't work because of my diabetes. I can't, nothing about I can't stand, nothing to go out and get the same type of job. and more importantly, no finding by the trial judge, and no attack that there was conclusively established or insufficient evidence for lack of finding. So when we've presented that, got a little bone to pick with that, because they're raising what they contend is evidentiary issues, that there was a piece of evidence that she couldn't work or that he was abusive. The trial court clearly did not believe Deborah Logsdon with regard to that testimony. And also, those are not challenged on appeal. So the only major findings we have are regard to the disproportionate award. And we've cited cases. You can look at these things. I think there's a variety of factors. If the legislature wanted this to be a straight economic dollar-for-dollar credit, like we see in dollar-for-dollar settlements, things of that nature where you get credit in those verdicts, they would have said so. Secondly, the cases we've cited, they're not dollar-for-dollar analysis on fraud. Third, with regard to that, we have a disagreement about the amount of money, which is $290,000. Fourth, we have all these transactional costs with regard to the receivership and the attorney's fees that were incurred. Fifth, a party shouldn't benefit from getting caught conducting fraudulent activity. I don't think we want to reward that type of conduct. And sixth, it's a breach of the trust and the fiduciary duty where spouses are held to a higher standard.
Mr. Michel, concerning the fraud, when there's, because the parties were married for 28 years, and when there's a, I'm asking you, if is there an inference that if you prove actual fraud, in other words, could it have been the legislature's intent in not providing a dollar for dollar, that if you are able to prove, because it is your burden, actual fraud, that there's some kind of inference that this has been transpiring for an extended period of time? Because it's a heavy burden to prove actual fraud. And I mean, I'm just.
I agree.
Are you aware of any legislative history behind 7.009, or are you.
Only other than with tying in with Schluter and the results of the legislature trying to address those issues and the nature of marital fraud. That's what we're aware of, Your Honor, is these issues are obviously hard to prove. The spouses have the higher burden. And I've always thought it was quite, this court knows I argue these cases a lot, and I've always found it quite marriage in such an odd, it's not a partnership. It's not just a pure business partnership, right, where we think of economics. And it's just not purely a romance-loving relationship. It's the unique, it is really a unique area of combination. And that's why it's not just economic. That's why the legislature, in my opinion, did not do dollar for dollar. Because of those six or seven factors I've listed, it is a combination of those factors. As I follow this law, Justice Walker, I had expected if that's the route the legislature wanted to go, they would have dictated to the trial judge, I want you to reconstitute the estate, and I want you to penalize that wrongdoing spouse dollar for dollar for the fraud that was proven. They didn't do that. And I actually see why. And that dovetails in with kind of the history of these type of cases. When you look in the marriage relationship and all the damage that this type of act of fraud can do, and involving the child, and the additional expense to go on top of it, I think they wanted to vest that discretion with the trial court, and that's what Judge Harris did. Our opinion, it could have been a lot worse. I mean, I think we're close to really just maybe the actual close out-of-pocket of additional expenses and costs that were incurred. Virtually no penalty. I mean, this is a 6-point swing on percentage. Would ask the court to affirm the judgment in all respects.
Would you speak very quickly on the issue of child support? It was raised in the brief.
It was, yes.
And I'm going to ask them a question probably, so I want you.
I think it's, first of all, moot right now. The child is over 18 years of age. I think. And going to college. Anyways, I think it's moot at this point. Number two, neither parent was given custody of the child. So why would Deborah Logsdon be awarded child support? Why would Mark Logsdon be awarded child support? They've made no showing as to why she should get it. And third, Judge Harris found, given the situation of this family and the child being 17 years age, and basically running uncontrolled, was de facto emancipated. That neither my client has got no control over it, and Deborah Longson has no control. In fact, we've cited in the record, Justice Sutterith, that while the daughter was in charge of the, was in charge by the wife, you know, she was missing hundreds of days of schools, failing. My client comes involved, gets her to school on time, makes the honor roll. They've made no showing that Deborah Logsdon would have been awarded custody and would have been entitled to child support.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Michelle. Mr. Gilstrap.
As to child support, the husband didn't want the child. The child was living with the mother. She should get child support. I can't imagine why the judge didn't give it to her. But again, that's probably only a year's child support. The larger issue of the money and the property, counsel says that the legislature did not mandate a dollar for dollar credit. That's true, but what's the purpose of reconstituting the estate if you're not gonna do something like that? The legislation has to mean something. According to him, the law is just like it was before at the time of Schluter. Now, he says that we've found cases, that we haven't found any cases where there's a dollar-for-dollar credit, and he cites cases. In all of those cases, there were other MRF factors. In this case, there's only going to be one MRF factor, if we're right, and that is a $13,000 quote, $13,000 fraudulent transfer and a $575,000 disparity. It is half of that. If we rectified the disparity, yes, it would come to half of that. Each would get a half of that. But right now, the husband's getting $575,000 more than the wife for a $13,000 transfer. He says, well, we had all these expenses of ownership and expenses of attorney's fees and the receivership, and we had mental anguish, and he had emotional damage. They didn't prove up any of that at trial. The receiver did not segregate his fees, and the judge said each side bears its own attorney's fees. If they want to try that, we welcome it. Let's remand the case for a new trial. They can then prove that up. And so far as the Beanie Baby argument, they say, well, she bought all these Beanie Babies, and now they're worth a lot less. There's no evidence that they're worth a lot less. They're a collector's item. They may be worth more. There's just no evidence. They were valued. They were given to the wife. Why are the Beanie Babies having anything to do with this case other than it's a way to prejudice the wife? Because, after all, she collected Beanie Babies. She must lose. On the case against the son, he was a third-party defendant. The plaintiff has to prove his case. The proper result, and the plaintiff didn't prove his case because he didn't prove ownership. The proper result is the plaintiff takes nothing. The third party plaintiff takes nothing. And the son gets to keep the property. And that means we have to go back for a new division. Finally, it says we're benefiting. We want to benefit from our activities. No, we're not benefiting. We want our half, that's all. And then the judge obviously got down on the wife and he drove it right up to the edge. But I think when he said that $13,000 leads to a $575,000 disparity, he abused his discretion. There's no reasonable basis. Well,
isn't there a reasonable inference that if this fraud has been going on and they're able to prove, despite the fact that it was recovered by the receiver and despite the fact that the receiver did a very good job, isn't there a reasonable inference that this type of behavior had been going on for an extended period of time, and if there's this much that was discovered, there's at least as much that wasn't discovered?
That is not a reasonable inference because they have the burden of proof. They have to identify property. And they could have said, well, yes, we think that she wrote $100,000 checks 10 years ago. Maybe that's it. But they didn't say that. The receiver said he got back all the property. if they have the burden of proof.
I thought he said he got back all that he was aware of.
All that he was aware of, and all that he is aware of is all that there is evidence of. That's my answer on that one. Okay.
Have you calculated the ratio? I can't do the math just sitting here. On 13,000 versus 575, do you know what the ratio is?
No, I haven't, but...
The reason I ask that is because in that Bennett versus Reynolds case out of the Supreme Court, they talked about punitive damages and they talked about the ratio. And I know this isn't a punitive damage case, but this is a punitive argument.
I think it's about a 5-to-1 ratio. I'm guessing my math is not that good, but I believe it's about a 5-to-1 ratio. If you'll recall, in the law of punitive damages, as decided by the Gore factors, which were discussed in Bennett, when there's no physical harm, the court's hardly going to ever go over a 1-to-1 ratio. 5-to-1 has never flown with the Texas Supreme Court, and that's what we got here. So if the goal is punishment, and I don't think that's a permissible goal, the punishment was excessive. It needs to go back, and the judge you need to tell the judge what the rules are on redividing the estate. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Gilstrap. And Mr. Kolodowski, we thank you for your arguments. Thomas Michelle, attorney for the appellee, we appreciate your arguments and everybody's briefing in this matter. Your case is now submitted and you are excused. We will recess until 10:30 when we'll take up the 10:30 cases.